My pastures are plenty. Hard road. California, Arizona, the pastures of plenty must always be free.
You're listening to a party live from the Freight and Salvage in Berkeley. Goodbye, Pete, a remembrance of Pete Seeger on KPFA, KPFK, and KRCB. I'm Mary Tilson.
I'm Robin Pressman, and it is a party, Mary. There are hundreds of people out in the street where the street is closed in front of the Freight and Salvage tonight. People are dancing in the lobby.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, a recorded edition of the program, featuring a reading held only last night at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, featuring Nancy Hightower and D.T. Friedman. Well, I had very definite plans for tonight's show, the idea being that I was not going to do just a Pete Seeger special because, thankfully, everybody at the station, almost everybody, has been doing their part, their bit. And I do have some Pete Seeger stories to tell and all that. But what the remembrance of Seeger's life has done for me personally is, A, it reminded me of a few incidents, which I will get into, and B, what the village scene was like in the late 60s, early 70s. I was even there in the early 60s, but not at an age where I could truly appreciate it. And having recently seen a wonderful documentary that's available on Netflix about Greenwich Village folk music, as well as the somewhat controversial movie Inside Llewyn Davis, which actually I did like quite a bit. I just don't see it as a representation of what the scene was supposed to be like. That's merely a setting. But we'll get into that. Okay. The point is, I was going to do an all-folky show, which would also provide a good premise for asking for money from you, the idea of this particular fund drive being that the program is the premium. Well, that is a concept that I have always appreciated, and I am pleased that we are able to do it. But to do the folky show that I had in mind, it needs to be freeform. I need to be at the station with various resources available. I'm very sorry that I don't have reel-to-reel tape recorder available because there are some old-style recordings that I have that I would like to employ and turntable, etc., etc. But I do have virtually unlimited access to music digitally and, yes, legally, and want to, well, do that live, do that freeform, the way that late night radio tends to be here at WBAI. So we're swapping around. I am intending to do that program next week, where theoretically I'll be able to get up to CCNY. And this week, well, we had an event last night at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And when I say last night, by the way, I mean Tuesday night, February 4th. If you're in New York and you're hearing this live, it was Thursday. It was Tuesday. Today is Thursday. But it depends. Yeah, you might be listening to this on-demand stream. So it could be a couple of weeks ago. At any rate, we had Nancy Hightower and D.T. Friedman, both people who have been on the show in the last 3 months, Nancy just last week, and Danielle Friedman, doctors both, by the way, were drawing a tremendous crowd. It was wonderful. We had somewhere over 60 people show up in weather that, well, actually the weather was fine, but it was threatening. It was threatening weather. And we had all these celebrities in the audience. I mean, people showing up from San Francisco. Charlie Jane Anders, who read for us a couple of years ago and is chief writer and I believe one of the editors at IO9 magazine, and people from any number of publishing companies, some literary agents. It was cool. We had a great time, and it was a great evening, and I thought, why not broadcast that tonight? Broadcasting readings that I produce or that other people produce and I record has always been a part of Hour of the Wolf. The reading series that I'm currently running, it has been running for 23 years, the KGB reading series for something like 12 or 13 years. And sometimes we broadcast entire events. Sometimes we broadcast, you know, one reader or another along with an interview. But last night's reading was so cool and so good that I thought I would bring you the entire thing. But, not without cost. What does that cost? Oh, well, that's up to you. I suggest $25. Become a subscriber to WBAI. I mean, here's the deal and here's the idea. The program is the premium. I'm giving you the program and I'm asking you, pay for it. It's not just WBAI, although that's ultimately where the money goes, WBAI and Pacifica Radio, but it's for the radio station that allows programming like this. If you tune in some other non-commercial radio in New York City, you might hear a produced program of selected shorts, and that is a fine series. Don't get me wrong. But it's a different kind of a thing, and it happens a few times a year. I think it's 13 episodes a year or something like that. We do this here on Hour of the Wolf every week. Simon Locally reads you story and deals with literary issues every week. Max Schmidt brings you radio drama every week. And this is what makes WBAI special. And we're not the only one in Pacifica Radio. We have four other stations. I believe at least one other does similar literary kind of programming regularly. There's Destinies, which is at a college station that a few people here at BAI, including Lister, who will be coming up at 3 o'clock, is affiliated with. That's WUSB, and Howard does, although they tend not to do readings. That's an interview show. And there are some podcasts one of which, by the way, I now host. I host, don't produce, but I host the Lightspeed Magazine podcast. At any rate, the point is, for radio, this is it. Complete stories, uninterrupted, commercial-free, as they say on one of my favorite TV stations, uninterrupted and commercial-free. And a major difference, we have the writer doing the reading. At most places, including selected shorts, they have professional, I would call them readers, but the parlance today is narrators. And that is not the specialty that I bring you. I bring you the writer's voice. I bring you the writers to talk about their work, read you their work, and then, time permitting, we take phone calls. And then I go out and I record events such as the one that you're going to be hearing very shortly. It's the writer's voice. It's science fiction, speculative fiction, fantasy, call it what you will. It's imaginative literature read to you by the people whose imaginations are being shared. And you can imagine that the radio station that provides the forum for this is therefore in and of itself a bit of a special place. And I don't think I need to tell you that it is very, very endangered. We're not talking about crisis mode. WBAI has been in crisis mode since the day I started volunteering for WBAI, which was in the middle of 1967. This is near extinction. Even should Pacifica survive, there will still be a question, an issue of WBAI and various different options, what will be done, what can be done, because we are Pacifica's most valuable asset. And as such, we are considered a key player to their survival. And that means things. We need to prove, as we have proved in the last fundraising drive, that listener sponsorship works and that WBAI works and that we are more valuable to Pacifica as a part of Pacifica, run by ourselves, than any other configuration. There are, by the way, other configurations that don't sound horrible, I must say. But boy, would they be radically different. And there are a few things here worth saving. A few. Well, two anyway. No, there's more. But the idea is that it's incumbent on you to make a phone call or visit a website and donate money. $25 is the recommended price to become a subscriber for WBAI. It's also the minimum price. You want to give more, please don't let me stop you. But make a phone call now. 212-209-2950. Again, in New York City, 212-209-2950 is the number to call. If you would rather do it online, you can go to WBAI.org and follow the links there to donate. And be sure when you say, what is your favorite show? Well, it's called Hour of the Wolf. But you knew that already, didn't you? There's another website. It's GIVE2. That's the numeral 2, WBAI.org. But you know what? It's a lot easier to just go to WBAI.org and follow the links. That's what I recommend. And it's even easier to make the phone call, 212-209-2950. I'd say, oh, I see calls are coming in, but I'm a recording. So, I trust there are calls coming in. I trust that you're doing it. I trust that you're supporting Hour of the Wolf, literary radio on WBAI, arts programming on WBAI. You want to know why? Well, just keep listening. Because you're about to hear some. As we're saying, the program is the premium. So, Set your Wayback Machine for the evening of February 4th, scheduled to start at 7, but we started at 7:14, which is about average for us, for me anyway. And you will be hearing first Nancy Hightower, then we'll take a break, and then you will hear D.T. Friedman. All in all, it's the two doctors. Here we go.
Welcome. We are in the home stretch of the 23rd season of the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. I am Jim Freund. Tonight's reading has a theme, as we're going to have circus people next time. Welcome to the two doctors. There they go. One is an MD and with awesome credits, and the other one is a PhD in what exactly? Well, I'll tell you. Nancy Hightower is a speculative fiction author and poet, as well as an art critic who writes for Weird Fiction Review. Her debut fantasy novel, Elementary? Elementary Rising, I got it wrong on the air last week three times, was published in September 2013 with Pink Narcissus Press and received a starred review from Library Journal and was chosen as debut of the month. She has co-authored with Carrie Ann... The Cute and Creepy Exhibition Catalog, an art book of contemporary macabre and surrealist works. She has also reviewed works for Fantasy Matters and interviewed writers such as China Mieville, Neil Gaiman for DJ Spooky's Origin Magazine. Currently, she reviews fantasy and science fiction for, what's that place called? Oh, The Washington Post. On the academic side, Nancy has a PhD in English, creative writing, from the University of Denver, and previously taught the rhetoric of the fantastic, uncanny, and grotesque in art and literature at the University of Colorado. Her short fiction and poetry have appeared in over 20 publications, including the New York Quarterly, Word Riot, Story South, Strange Horizons, Bourbon Pen, Prick of the Spindle, Liquid Imagination. Oh, I should mention we have a sewing machine. That table in front has a sewing machine. It really is. It really is. I'll see it later. The aforementioned Electric Velocipede and Neon, among others. She moved to New York City last July, and having landed a place in the East Village, is now in food heaven, which is why when she gets her next job, we're not going to allow her to leave. But she's here tonight, Nancy Hightower.
Am I sounding okay with the mic?
Yeah.
Good? All right. So this is my first sort of long story to read. I'm used to reading more flash fiction and poetry, but we're going to give it a go. This is called Found, and it's going to appear in Bourbon Pen issue 9. What's it like? She asks. And he knows better than to tell her, but she nudges him in the arm again. They had instructed him to tell her stories. Help her get through the pain, they whispered as they wheeled him into a room. The first thing he saw was a moonscaped little face, deep pockmarks and shiny red folds of skin crisscrossed over where her nose should be. Don't ask her what happened. Just spin her one of those fantastic tales of yours. Tell me, please. They are eye to eye, he in the chair, she in the bed. Neither of them could get very far in this state, even if they had help. Her arms are crossed now to show she's getting impatient. He smiles, knowing what she wants, the little imp. First off, the sun's too bright where I'm from. He spits on the floor. Can't see a damn thing when you're up that far. The ground glitters like diamonds, especially after a fresh snow. All that white surrounding you, except for the trees. Her brown eyes widen. They're so dark he can't tell where the iris begins and the pupil ends. She's an alien being just like him, caught in this sterile little hellhole. You're not an alien, Nurse X keeps reminding him. You had a skiing accident. One of them got you, didn't they? The girl whispers. And he's about to tell her how only the Vernet, one of the elder trees, could snatch a flyer right out of the air if you were gliding low enough. Don't go scaring the girl, Marcus. Out of nowhere, an orderly steps in between them to mop up the spittle he has so emphatically just deposited upon the floor. Make it one of those nice tales so Bebby can get some sleep tonight. Why do you want her to keep her awake with stories about monsters? Marcus doesn't consider himself a monster, even though he can kill a large game with one swipe of his claws, now bandaged lumps and much smaller. Although the Vernet are a different matter. The orderly leans against the mop as if he's resting after such strenuous exercise. Don't you worry, he tells Bebby. No Vernet could ever catch me. It's a lie, of course. A Vernet had caught him. It was the reason he was here in the wheelchair. But if they didn't like him to talking about it, so be it. It's the risk one takes to see that sea of snow split open by fire, and it's where the ice worms perform their mating dances. You've never seen such wonder, little one. Circle upon circle carved into and around the fire chasm where it's warm enough for them to lay their eggs. The girl points towards the door as the orderly disappears. That one moves too quietly, she says under her breath. Every time I try to get out of bed, he's there. Can you walk, he asks, trying to piece together what happened to her. Burn victim, they had muttered, but the girl remembers no fire. Her shoulder blades are heavily wrapped in gauze, but no other part of her appears to have suffered burns except for her face. She pulls up her hospital gowns to show tiny feet. I've tried when they're not looking, but it's hard. She wiggles her toes and frowns, as if I'm not used to them. He looks a bit wistfully. His legs have been amputated below the knees. His never resembled anything like hers anyway. Flyers soared through the ice mountains upside down, their long webbed feet crossed, outflying even the largest of birds. She smooths her dressing gown back over her legs. When do you think we can leave? Healing as quick as you are, soon enough, he lies again. Her face is more pink than red at this point, and her hair, which had been shaved off, is trying to grow back, but only succeeding in small black patches. No, leaving here isn't contingent on getting better. Otherwise, he'd have been discharged over a month ago. I wish they would let me play with the other kids, she sighs, but the nurse says I could still catch something contagious. That nurse says a lot of things, he starts, but then a doctor walks in and says that their visiting hour is over. An orderly wheels him back to his room on the first floor. He sees fewer children running about the main room today than he's seen in weeks and wonders where they have disappeared to. There are no women patients anywhere, just children on the second floor and broken men on the first. The men shuffle by him, muttering to themselves, never looking up. I know it's difficult, Nurse X says to him later in their session. She's so close to your daughter's age. His daughter died in a car wreck the year before his skiing mishap. At least, that's the story that kept feeding him. But he had no daughter. Flyers can't procreate. They are guards of the city they're born into. No family ties to keep them bound to the land. The trees are their houses, at least the ones don't see him as a ripe, tasty meal. You can't fly, Nurse X argues. Her tone is always gentle when she corrects him, thin lips set in a half smile. Those feet you claim to have had, they were skis. You fell into the trees while on a jump, and that is where these images are coming from. Let's talk about the loss of your lower legs.
And the fact that he hadn't seen a woman patient?
Women and teenage girls are an entirely different wing, Marcus, she sighs. Her smile tightens. Once you get stronger with your interactions with people, we'll take you around the hospital and you can see. Now let's talk about who you were before the accident. She shows him a picture of a little girl with short, dark hair, almost the same color as Bebe's, and a woman who must have been her mother. He's not sure how old Bebe is, maybe 7 or 8. The little girl in the picture is a few years younger, maybe 5. He recognizes neither of them, even though the nurse keeps saying that they are his wife and daughter. His wife? She left after your daughter's accident. And was he responsible for his daughter's death? Nurse X refuses to answer. Let's work backwards. Let's discuss the skiing accident. You were on a black diamond trail. Remember how fast you were going? He remembers nothing but flying through the air, scouting for the last ice worms that tried to burrow into the city. They were shallow travelers, leaving lawn trails in the fresh powder. His job was to find them, head them off, and extricate them mid-journey. They often didn't stand a chance against his claws, but some gave up a good fight when they were full grown. A Vernet grabbed me on one of my patrols, he explains. They were the true predators. They would eat ice worms, flyers, anything that ventured near them. I was tired, sloppy. I didn't see it on my left. He doesn't bother telling her about the 9-foot worm he seized right as it was about to enter the outer city lines. If it penetrated the city, a creeper would be have to let loose. And there was always loss of life during that chase. This worm knew it was almost inside, wound itself quickly around his body as he was trying to climb the elevation. They both nearly fell to their deaths. You went off course and flew into the trees, she counters. It's amazing you're even alive and kept so much of your legs and hands given the extent of your injuries. We can fit you with prosthetics soon. He nods, trying to seem agreeable. He doesn't want anything to do with their human limbs. Why bother walking when you can fly? True healing, Marcus, she continues, happens when we own our stories. This fantasy life only keeps you isolated and doesn't help you interact with reality. First, we must work through your accident. Then we'll move through to your daughter's death. Your conversations with Bebe have really helped lift her spirits. She'll need that strength in the coming weeks. The muscles in his neck tense up. He has no deep-seated affection for the girl, but they brought him into her room to talk twice a week for the past month. At once, he saw she was like him, not of this world. Not of his species, at least, and nothing akin to the different peoples he had seen in the forests or the cities, but something seemed familiar about her. They were wounded aliens, captives. He leans forward. What's going to happen to her? The nurse scribbles down something on the chart in front of her, and he can tell his reaction pleases her in some way. The wounds on her back aren't healing like they should. We're keeping a close eye on her, but we may have to take her back in and clean them out. It's a painful procedure, and her recovery might be slower this time. You can help her with that. He tries to keep his face impassive. Flyers don't form emotional attachments to anything. It is part of who they are. She's been murmuring odd things in her sleep. We need to get her calmer. Try to remember your daughter. The nurse slips the picture of the girl and her mother underneath his bandaged fist. Whatever was left of his claws. Maybe you both can help begin to heal through this experience. They wheel him back to his room. There's a thing that lies in the bed across from him, wrapped head to toe in a filmy gauze coated in aloe. They say it's a man, but the shape is too bulbous for a human body, and thus far Marcus has only heard gurgling noises emanate from what he supposes is a mouth. We needed to pad his torso to protect his organs, the orderly explains. We're not sure if he's going to make it, but we've named him Ash. Usually they draw a curtain between them, but not tonight. Tonight he sits alone with his thoughts and a picture of two people he's never seen before, listening to Ash's wheezing. They can call him human if they want, if it makes them feel better. But humanity wasn't a choice. Born with claws for hands and extended feet, you're a flyer. Born with abnormally large eyes and double rows of teeth, you become a creeper. One lives outside the city, the other underneath it. A wife and child, those are for another man, another life. But Nurse X is never going to let him leave this hospital thinking that, oh no, he'll be trapped here forever unless he starts to play their game. Over the next week, he has more sessions. He is never taken outside and wonders if there is sun and snow on this planet. He wonders if they can see the stars in the sky or if they've been washed out by all the tower lights, as in his own capital. He tries to forget his world as Nurse X asks him questions about the girl in the picture, tries to figure out what is it that she wants. Do you remember taking your daughter for bike rides? She shows him a picture of the girl on what must be a bike. It looks like a ridiculous contraption. Try to think of the wind on your face, how it felt going down a hill. What does she sound like? Is there laughter? He closes his eyes, and the only sound he hears is screaming. He jerks back, unsure what it means. No, Marcus, close your eyes again. You were remembering something. What was it? It doesn't have to be laughter. He does as she asks, whispers something about a little girl screaming. You're starting to remember the accident. Let yourself go there. He drifts deep into the past, but all he sees is blinding white and a cruel blast of winter air on his face. What are you feeling? He's terrified, but he doesn't tell her he's flying through the air faster than a hawk, trying to reach a little girl, then an ice worm snatched up in its toothless jaws and is taking back to its lair. The ice worm senses a chase, speeds along the surface towards its nest, while the girl's scream echoed throughout the canyon. It is only a matter of feet now, and he dives, reaching out a claw to scoop her up. She reaches out a hand, seeing her chance to be saved, but in that moment, the ice worm burrows down, and they are lost in the deep snow. He wipes away the tear running down his cheek and suddenly curses the nurse, who is jotting down more notes. Doesn't she understand there's no emotional depth to explore here, only issues of injustice? The girl was someone's daughter, and they had set her outside the city for the ice worms. There was no way that children could have wandered past the guards, but in times of famine or political unrest, parents would sacrifice one of their own in order to save the family. It was almost always a girl. What else do you remember? Nurse S asks again. Play their game. He talks in the vaguest terms possible of screams carried along the winter wind, of trying to save a little girl but not being able to. It's all still so fuzzy, he claims, looking as helplessly cooperative as possible. Nurse X nods. It's a beginning, Marcus. You're starting to remember. When can I see Bebe again? In a couple of days, she's not doing so well. Here, keep the picture. Back in the room, Ash's gurgling is incessant. It tries to move, but the two limbs that could resemble arms wave about in odd patterns. It's not a human gesture. Can you hear me? He asks it from the bed. The gurgling stops momentarily as if in response. Can you speak? Ash babbles something that might be words, but he can't understand them. The limbs start to flail about more dramatically. Listen, they'll come in here the more you do that. Lie still until it gets dark and less of them are on duty. He's not sure Ash understands half of what he's saying, but soon enough the arms lay still. He finds himself growing anxious about Baby. His legs became infected shortly after coming here. He's still not sure how he lost them. One moment he was flying through the air, tall evergreens on either side of him. The next, he was snatched up by a vernet whose branchy arms were about to rip off his head. He remembers hearing an unfamiliar whir and then a whoosh of air before waking up here on his back. Those first few weeks, his legs would ache badly, and then there were needles that delivered an endless sleep. At times, he was out for days and awoke with new dressings and in worse pain. But wherever there was pain, there were the needles that erased it. What if they're planning to do the same thing to Bebe? The thoughts keep him up late into the night, so late that he's awake when Ash begins to stir in the pitch-black room. From the rustling sounds and labored breathing, he understands that it's trying to roll over, and for a moment, he worries that it might be able to. He's not sure if it can move without legs. Perhaps its mode of transport is its upper limbs. That might be all it needs to get some kind of traction to jump off the bed. But no, the rustling stops after a moment, and the only sound he hears is Ash's labored breathing. Fruh. Mah. The words are croaked from the passageway left open for it and have a strange kind of echo. Its voice, while not human, is definitely female. He tenses, waiting to see what else the thing will say. Fruh. Mah. He hears her strain against the dressings, rubbing the two limbs this way and that. Stop. They will come in here if you struggle like that, he warns. He wonders if he should hit the red button himself and ask for the orderly to come look at her, but something, the predator sense that all flyers are born with, tells him not to. He waits, but hears no more from her for the rest of the night. That prolonged struggle might have expended her reserves. Tomorrow, he will find out exactly who Ash is and what. But Ash's body is gone in the morning. Had to replace his dressing, Orly says when he asks about her. Somehow it came off in the night. Doesn't understand that it's for his own good, poor thing. It doesn't make sense why they keep calling her a him unless, perhaps, Marcus is the only one to have heard her speak. There's no time to process all this as he's wheeled into Bebe's room. Her face lights up when she sees him, although she has a tube hooked up into her arms. The bandages around her shoulders are thicker. It hurts when they touch me there, she says in a small voice. It's been hurting worse at night. They took off the dressing yesterday and said my back wasn't healing properly. He feels like the correct response would be to reach out and pat her leg in sympathy, but his claw is only a small bound thing at the end of his arm. Keep her calm. The nurse says you've been talking in your sleep. Any stories to unravel my own? Sometimes I dream I'm flying with you. She casts down her eyes. I know that's not possible. All flyers are boys. Not true. Girl flyers are twice as vicious as any boy flyer, but they live higher up in the mountains in bands, whereas we fly alone. She gets that stubborn look in her eye. But I fly with you. I'm sure of it. He looks at her legs. With those feet? Little face gets serious. Her lip threatens to quiver. He has taken the wrong turn. Then again, maybe your dreams are signaling you're not getting sicker, but better. She perks up a bit, but doesn't offer any more information about her flying dream, having been discouraged thus far. He looks at the patches of hair, the flaps of skin that make something of a nose. You know, you could be changing into what you really are, he offers. Those bandages are just to keep you from getting infected as you morph. He thinks about the gauze that had Ash wrapped up so tightly she could barely move, and his own hands. What if these dressings weren't keeping all the bacteria out, but something in? Tell you what, he whispers, suddenly feeling sick and afraid. When I come back tomorrow, we'll talk more about how you want to fly. Try to remember those dreams. Back in his room, he stares at the little girl in the picture. He imagines Bebe in her sparse hair. When he is wheeled into Nurse X's office later that afternoon, she congratulates him on getting Bebe to open up. She had stopped talking to the doctors, and they were worried about her pain levels. Can I see her tomorrow, he asks. And again, she scribbles something in her notebook. I'm not sure, Marcus. We'll have to take her into surgery sooner than anticipated, given that the fever is starting to rise. His stomach turns again. There's something she's not telling him. Suddenly, an alarm sounds, feet running. He wonders if Ash has escaped, but this is a fleeting concern, for Nurse X has rushed out of the room, leaving her notes behind. He wheels over, catches a glimpse of his chart. Marcus P., schizoid personality disorder. Memory integration thus far only semi-successful. Medicate if necessary. He reaches over, clumsily picks up the charts with his bound hands and pushes the first sheet up, page after page, until he finally sees Bebby's name. Abnormal growth. Possibly cancerous. Amputation required. She's scheduled for surgery in 2 days. The alarm has stopped, causing him to flatten back the pages and wheel away from the nurse's chair. When she enters, her face has lost its normal placid countenance. He attempts to show concern. Is everything all right? Yes, Marcus, thank you for asking. His question has brought back her smile. She believes she's making progress. One of the patients had an allergic reaction. That sometimes happens when the treatment is experimental. He holds up the picture of the daughter, the one who looks so much and so little like Bebe. Was I responsible for her death? He waits, doesn't even realize he's holding his breath. She hesitates. We'll talk about it next week if you're ready. He nods, stares at the pictures, traces the outline of the little face. At least let me see Bebe before she goes into surgery. She was so scared. Again, the hesitation. We'll see how she fares tonight, okay? No promises. She ends the session early. Ash's body is wheeled in that evening. She is wrapped in new bandages end to end. Even the two limbs have been taped to her side. He's been allowed to sit longer in his chair today, especially since he's not put away the picture of the girl. Out of the corner of his eye, he watches the orderlies hook Ash up to needles and tubes. They have her in dreamland where perhaps she wanders these halls as a human. The sight makes him worry about what they will do to Bebe. Perhaps they can save her, yes, if she's truly dying. But what if she isn't? The girl might wind up like Ash and him, subject to operations where any part that wasn't human was cut out, bound up. If she truly is sick, then it's possible that he has a wife somewhere, a dead daughter. Which reality can he dare to live in? A desperate hoarse whisper finally emerges from Ash. Fra. Ma. He wheels over to her bed, leans toward the exaggerated bulbous form just to hear better. What? What do you want? Fra. Ma. Free. Ma. The words, the rough words, grow clearer. Free. Me. He is a flyer, a predator. He understands what to do. Because of the commotion today, the lunch tray has been left in the room. The plastic eatingware is not sharp, but it's enough. He grabs a knife and tries to saw through the gauze. It's not easy to do, not without hands, but his arms have not lost their strength. These arms that could pick up an ice worm. He saws, glancing at the door, expecting it to open at any moment. Ash lies very still, seeming to sense what is going on. He first frees the limbs, and she holds them down while he begins near what must be her face. He tears through the dressing to find coarse hair soaked in some kind of chemical. There is a strange heat emanating from her. He tries not to think about what he is unleashing, what she is capable of. He is giving himself over to this narrative. They are strangers in this world, held captive. Enough of the bandages have come off to reveal a furred face with more than two black eyes staring at him. He frees more limbs, which begin to wriggle. He wheels back as Ash's legs twist themselves out of the needles. He has already opened the door when he hears her roar, "Fly!" It's now a race. He wheels down the darkened corridors, turns to the elevators. The alarm sound, screams, and a burst of red light cause even more chaos, allowing him to wheel into an open elevator and punch the button for the second floor. He still has the knife from the room and tries to saw through his own dressings, but at this angle, it's impossible. The door opens, and he's surprised that no one is there to stop him. All is quiet on the children's floor. He wheels down the hall to Bebe's room. She is sitting up in her bed, crying. Marcus! Shh, shh. He comes to her side. Do you trust me? She nods. Cancer, they say. Pickle world. He bends over, lets his teeth gently graze the tape, securing the needle in her arm. Then he pulls the tube and needle out with his mouth. Bebe whimpers only once, but as soon as he holds out his arm, she crawls into his lap. Hold on, he whispers. Her little arms wrap around his neck as he heads out the corridor. There are many people running now, and there are shots on this floor, too. They hear an explosion which rocks the building and starts the sprinklers above. Ash, he thinks. It is raining now, and the lights are off except for a dim blue bulb that offers barely a glow. They find the elevator, and many people rush out, nurses, guards, doctors. No one seems to notice that in the dark. They go in, hit the button for the first floor, and in a moment they're there. The door opens to show Nurse X. Marcus, she yells, her face both shocked and oddly exultant. He rams the chair right into her, wheels hitting her shin and knocking her over. Bebby holds on, not even looking at her, and Marcus swerves past just as the nurse reaches out to stop them. Down the corridors they go, trying to find one that leads to the outside. He has never hunted for it, never wanted it, but now all he can dream of is the wind on his face and of sky, even if it's no longer his sky. Finally, he sees it, two glass doors that have been shattered. Something else has already escaped. On the other side, a desert horizon. A group of doctors spy them from across the room. He heads for the entrance, and a heartbeat clears the door, followed by shouts of, "Watch out!" when a giant form suddenly cuts them off. Marcus swerves and barely has enough time to register a multi-limbed, fanged creature with flames racing down each leg. Baby holds on tighter as he races forward, feeling like he is lost in a dream. Ash's voice hunts them from behind. "Fly, fly, fly!" He feels heat emanating all around them. Bebe furiously claws at her bandages, somehow rips them off just as they approach a makeshift ramp. There is no place else to turn. In a flash, he sees once more the little girl in the worm's mouth, her hands reaching up for him. In another moment, they turn into a daughter's arms grasping her daddy as metal crunches and glass shatters. The wheels meet ramp. A cry from Ash as her spider form fully blazes into a fireball. Up and up they go as the wounded nubs in Bebe's shoulders burst open to release giant gossamer wings. Doesn't matter whether the wings are real or not. They are finally together, lifted higher and higher into the starless night, never to fall again.
You have been listening to Nancy Hightower, recorded Tuesday night, February 4th, 2014, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And right now, I hope that you're all getting yourself apple cider and cheese and crackers, which is what the audience was doing at that time. But at the same time, I also want you to go and make a phone call to WBAI's pledge line, 212-209-2950. You've now heard half of tonight's reason why you should do that. You heard Nancy Hightower reading, and you're about to hear Danielle T. Friedman reading. And both were just really wonderful, and as you heard, great audiences and all that. But we're during a fund drive, right? I mean, it seems to be nonstop, and we're looking for ways for that to change. But right now, this is the model. And the model that we are using this fund drive, according to Bob Hennelly, our latest program director, last three fund drives, including this one, three different PDs, right? Andrew Phillips, and then Berthold Reimers, our program director, our station manager was acting as program director, and now Bob Hennelly. So every single time I've got to say, you got to prove to this program director that this kind of programming is programming that matters to you. Literary programming, arts programming, and in the case of Hour of the Wolf, speculative fiction programming, fiction of the imagination, and a program in which you get to hear the writers who actually create this stuff reading to you, whether it's here on the air, as we have a guest most every week and sometimes just a recorded reading, or, as in this case, a recorded reading done in the field and sometimes pulled from the archives of Hour of the Wolf, which go back to, good Lord, 1972, when Margot Adler created this program. So, make a call now, 212-209-2950. Pledge $25, $50, $100, not only to keep WBAI Broadcasting and Pacifica Radio Alive, but also to show support for Hour of the Wolf. 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950. You are listening to Hour of the Wolf over WBAI in New York City. My name is Jim Freund, and you are listening to the entire event, reading event, that occurred last night, Tuesday night, that is to say, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, February 4th. And we are also in our fundraising drive. I trust that you've been calling often to pledge tonight, right? That you've called at least three or four times, 212-209-2950, to pledge your support, your financial support, for WBAI and for Hour of the Wolf. You can also go to the website at WBAI.org, follow the links, and when it asks you to list your favorite program, the program in whose name you are pledging, it's Hour of the Wolf. Heard over these airwaves since 1972. So we are now going to hear the second portion of last night's reading. And, well, by magic, I will now step into the TARDIS, go back in time to the evening of the two doctors, and introduce Danielle T. Friedman.
Okay, thank you, everybody, for coming. This is quite a crowd. I've counted 63 people, and that's a good number, I would say. Danielle T. Friedman, or D.T. Friedman for publication, is a writer whose work has appeared in venues such as Shimmer Magazine, Flash Fiction Online, and the Dark Faith Anthology. She is a member of the Codex Writers Group and is the newest member, still the newest?
Still the latest, newest
member of Altered Fluid. In her other life, she is a doctor of internal medicine with a specialization in urban underserved populations and is about to take a fellowship position in palliative medicine at Mass General. Yeah, exactly. She also occasionally... It gets cooler, if you can get cooler than that. She also occasionally provides medical advice to be used in fictional contexts. She has consulted with over 24 authors independently and through the Science and Entertainment Exchange, and recently an assisted, okay, with an episode of Castle. She is currently doing research on sickle cell disease, writing a novel, and taking some classes toward an MBA. That's her free time. She lives with a neurotic calico named Spoon Avocado, which is her brother's fault, and sometimes she juggles fire. Everybody, please welcome D.T. Friedman.
All right, so... I'm going to go YA on you guys. I hope you don't mind. Okay. So I'm going to read a couple of chapters from my book, Meridian Gridlock. I'm jumping in the middle, so I'm going to give you some background so you're not horribly lost, maybe just a little lost. We're going to be in near future Indianapolis, of all places. A woman named Teresa Hilaire has designed a medical technology called a birth that allows her to rescue a sick person's unaffected brain from their dying body. The birth supports the brain so they're able to continue to live their lives through a combination of a virtual world and a holographic interface that connects them to the real world. Bits of encoded sensory information called squirts are used to facilitate communication. The public initially rejected the technology completely. They were like, it's just a way for rich old people to cheat death and remain a burden on society. So Teresa found this little baby named Esther Bloom, who's dying from spinal muscular atrophy, built a PR campaign around her to change people's minds. And people were like, oh, it's to save babies. Oh, I guess it's okay then. So, not trying to be cynical or anything. So birth technology becomes a thing. Esty's brain is wired up and put in a vat, and she and her fellows are called Echoes. The virtual world that Echoes inhabit when they're not hanging out in the real world was rebranded as Baby Esty's Playground, and it's starting to supplant the internet. Baby Effie is now 15 years old. She goes to high school with the help of a holographic projector. She hangs out with her family, all of that stuff. And recently, Teresa's been putting her through a series of tests, which she says is supposed to help Effie's medical team figure out if they supported her correctly through puberty, but they may possibly have a more nefarious purpose. Effie listened happily to her family's banter, but it still felt like their words were coming to her from a distance, as if today's brush with emptiness re-emphasized the soap bubble fragility of the real world. It's been a day, she sent to her brother Jake's link. I gotta recharge. She didn't even wait for Jake's answer. He'd cover for her with Mom and Dad. Effie cast a quick glance into the birth room, making sure no one was paying particularly close attention to her cortical map. The coast was clear. Oh, good. With a swell of relief, Effie dove into her back loops. The paths she had carved into the unexplored virtuality stretched in all directions, possibilities upon possibilities. Down here, her reality was unbounded. She briefly considered pouring herself into the family car and drinking in every sensation she could squeeze out of its systems, but decided against it. No, it would feel better to manipulate something, to create something, have an impact on, you know, some part of the world. She could dig a new back loop. Yeah, perfect. She cast her awareness down one tunnel after another, poking around for ideas of where to expand her network. Restlessly, she discarded target after target. She didn't want to break into the files for the next installment of La Comista, the holodrama she and Jake were obsessed with these days. Half the fun of the show was speculating plot twists with Jake, and it wouldn't be fair to him to jump ahead. During a phase a few years ago, she had broken into one or two high-level government projects, only to panic and pull out of the databases, erasing evidence of her presence as she went. So nothing like that either. But what about Echo Corp? She had a flash of curiosity about what her bizarrely puberty-obsessed science team was saying about her. She had a few backloops into Echo Corp's systems. She could easily tunnel into R&D or the Echomed area or wherever else they were plotting their stupid tests. Decision made. She looped into her Echo Corp back door, a blip in the programming of the marketing department that opened practically the entire system to her explorations. She was thumbing happily through the location map, looking for the closest target to tunnel into when she felt something not quite right. She dropped what she was doing and withdrew into the back loop, a surge of guilty excitement freezing her into place. But she hadn't been caught. The feeling she got wasn't originating from anywhere in Echo Corp systems. It was coming from her back loops. Effie stayed frozen, assessing the area. She knew these tunnels like she knew her own name. She had built them herself and had practically lived in them for over half of her life. There wasn't supposed to be anything unfamiliar here. Or, she realized with a stab of fear, anyone. Far at the edge of her back loop network, under the Echo Corp system, there was a mind space. It wasn't moving. There was no feedback exchange going into or out of it. No squirts being sent to the playground, not even any connections that Effie could follow back to a point of origin. It was just there. Then Effie realized the invader had noticed her. A wave of terror swept away any residual memory of the emptiness she had felt during Teresa's test. She briefly thought about running, about abandoning this section of the back loops and closing them off behind her. But what was this mind space doing in her back loops? They were hers. No one was even supposed to know about them, let alone enter them without her knowledge or permission. This was Effie's world. This mind space had no right to be here. And anyway, Effie was powerful enough to defend her space. No one, no Echo or XNet, had ever been able to stop her from exerting control on the playground. With this certainty, she advanced on the intruder. The strange mind space didn't move as she approached. Effie gathered herself to expel it into the greater playground and seal whatever breach it had made into her back loops. The mind space lashed out and seized her. Effie yelped and surged back, but the connection was made. Filaments of the stranger entwined with her own mind space as if they were two amoebas interlocking with each other. She twisted and pulled, trying everything she could to claw her way out of the mind space's grasp, but every connection she broke, the intruder reasserted two more. Effie tried to retreat out of the back loops and into the greater playground, but the mind space grappled with her, catching any small tendril Effie reached out before she could use it for leverage. It intercepted every squirt she sent out, every call for help, every inquiry into what exactly this mind space was and what it wanted from her. And then Effie was surrounded. Everywhere she turned her awareness, the mind space was there. She called out again for Jake or her parents or Teresa or anyone who could get the message, but watched her squirt sink helplessly into the alien mind space. Was this a bot of some kind? A virus? Some attack from the Anti-Playground Coalition or the conglomerate? What could any of them possibly want from her? And then it spoke. Stay still. Are you crazy? They'll find us. Shocked and terrified, Esty obeyed without thinking. The mind space was a person, or at least talked like one. How could a person defeat Esty in a place she had created herself? She stopped her struggles and shrank into herself as she felt the intruding mind space scrutinizing her from all sides. Please, she managed. Quiet. The mind space returned to its examination. Esty felt its inquiries probing into her kernel of programming, demanding identity, shape, purpose. It itched. It was painful. She tried to squirm away, but the invasion continued from all sides. And then, just as suddenly as it began, it stopped. Dios en el cielo, the mind space said. Baby Esty. Esty took advantage of the mind space's momentary hesitation to try to punch out of her confinement. Her assailant threw her back as easily as before, but not before Esty managed to pull a name from its substance. From her substance. The name was a strange construction, a word accompanied by a squirt concept of color. Blue Linda, Esty said. If you must, what are you doing here? Blue Linda sounded genuinely confused. This made Esty feel a little safer, not much, but enough that she might be able to protect the secret of her back loops while she plotted her escape. I'm lost, Esty said. I took a wrong turn somewhere on the playground. I've been trying to get back. She gathered courage, decided to hide her lie with further boldness. Are you lost, too? No. Back to the silent scrutiny. Esty shifted a little. Now that Blue Linda knew who she was and what she was doing there, she'd let her go. But Blue Linda's grasp tightened around her again, and Esty froze. What do you know about Scheherazade? What? Scheherazade? Automatically, Esty reached toward the playground for some context. Scheherazade was a name she remembered, some mythological... No queries! Insensata! Do you want them to see? I don't know who... Tell me about Scheherazade! English class? That was where she had heard it, the woman who told the stories in the Thousand and One Nights, but what could that have to do with anything? Scheherazade, the queen whose husband threatened to kill her every day, she told him half a story? No. Blue Linda's mind space tightened ominously around her. Esty panicked. She couldn't concentrate on forming words anymore. The thoughts streamed out of her in an uncontrolled concept belch like a new echo who hadn't figured out how to drive her own language interface yet. Aladdin cliffhangers, Regal and Ganyu, Alibaba, Persian rugs, genie, enough! Please, I don't know what you want. No, said Blue Linda, almost thoughtfully. No, I don't think you do. Silence again. Esty realized that during these pauses, Blue Linda was turning her attention to the environment around them, scanning their surroundings. Like a real-world woman checking over her shoulder every few seconds, Blue Linda was clearly afraid of something, and that scared Esty even more. Desperate people did dangerous things. Please let me go. Esty hadn't gotten complete control back over her language interface. She hadn't meant to say that. She felt tiny and helpless. Blue Linda paused again. I can't. Her squirts took on an apologetic tone. I need you. With that, she broke the communication connection. She began to encroach on Esty's mind space. Esty shouted and struggled, but Blue Linda continued, shooting tendrils through Esty's mind space and beyond until she touched... What? What was she reaching for if not Esty herself? And then she realized, and the thought left her cold. Her birth... Blue Linda was breaking into her birth. From there, she'd have access to everything that connected Esty to the real world. She could control what Esty saw and heard and felt. She could control what Esty said and did. She could take over completely and leave Esty as an isolated brain, blank and screaming uselessly into her own mind forever. Esty did the only thing she could think of. She rebooted her birth, severing all connections to the playground, her back loops, her squirt library, even her monitoring computers. The only thing she kept was life support, all other connections gone. In a flash, Blue Linda's pressure disappeared from around her along with everything else. She had gone blank again, but this time it felt like being wrapped in a mantle of safe, empty anonymity. Esty curled around the kernel of herself, trying to calm down. She'd never been attacked before. Oh, she was so ashamed. How could Blue Linda have managed? Wasn't Esty supposed to be the master of her own playground? After an immeasurable amount of time, the shock of Blue Linda's intrusion started to fade slowly into the nothingness Esty floated in. She delayed her boot-up sequence over and over, reaching out into the void with tendrils of her attention and feeling a blissful nothing into infinity. And then she allowed her birth to reboot and emerged into a flurry of shouting and bright lights and strange sensations that slowly resolved into the medical team, running diagnostic after diagnostic on her birth and yelling arguments at each other and taking samples of her cerebrospinal fluid and turning themselves into a panic chaos that Esty had never seen before. "Hey!" Esty yelled over the din. She popped her avatar up in the middle of the crowd. Everyone backed away, giving the hologram space. Esty almost laughed at their shocked faces. "Hey, you don't have to worry. Everything's fine." Teresa separated herself from the throng as people exchanged glances and murmurs. Esty felt bad about scaring them. If she had known, she wouldn't have delayed her reboot so many times. "What happened?" asked Teresa. For a moment, Esty considered telling her everything. But there were so many people around. The thought of admitting that she hadn't been able to protect herself from Blue Linda's attack made her feel ashamed and stupid. And What if they decided to isolate her from the playground? They'd think it would be for her own protection, but that would be even worse than going blank. I rebooted my birth, she said finally. I did it on purpose. There's nothing wrong. You guys can go back to whatever you were doing. Slowly, with glances to Teresa to make sure she agreed, the medical team dispersed back to their usual stations. Teresa stayed. When the rest of the team had gone, she leaned in close to Esty's avatar. Her voice was thick with worry. "You were out for a full 48 minutes. Why did you do that?" Again, Esty considered telling her about Blue Linda, but her shame choked her. No, she couldn't tell anyone, not even Teresa. So she forced a light laugh through her language interface. "Puberty?" she offered. All right, I'm going to skip a couple of chapters here. And I'm going to change characters on you, too, because I'm feeling mean. So our next focus is Kendall Owens. Kendall and her father are homeless and living with Ms. Rita, her father's friend from church, who doesn't really treat Kendall very well. Kendall is a skilled, self-taught designer of squirt programs. She's trying to sell enough of them to get her father out of debt. She recently secured a scholarship to the Park School, a private school that has a lot more opportunities than the one she could get through the Indiana public school system. Shut up. Sorry, one of my high school classmates is here. And Kendall is one of Esty's classmates. Kendall has also befriended an artificial personality named Asa St. John, who has been helping her with programming. Asa is essentially a computer program based on the cortical map of a young man who died in a motorcycle accident. Asa, the artificial personality, is in trouble because he crashed a car he was driving by remote, leading to a huge societal backlash against artificial personalities and, by association, echoes as well. So the night before this section happens, Kendall tracked down the mother of the original human Asa St. John and tried to convince her to help defend the program that was based on her son, and it did not go well. Kendall tossed her bag into the Park School's side vestibule, tucking her picking wires back into her hair. By dumb luck, the Indigo bus routes had all fallen into place this morning, letting her skip the school buses entirely and depositing her at school a good hour and a half early. It was as if the universe was mocking Asa's absence. "See, you don't need him driving you to school. Your squirt programs are getting good even without his feedback. Not even his own mother thinks he should exist. He may as well rot in the bowels of the playground. He deserves nothing more than a flick of an off switch and an unmarked blink into non-existence." It wasn't fair. She kicked her bag across the vestibule, the thud of her sneaker less satisfying as a shot of pain lanced through her toe. Stupid. Stupid to think Mrs. St. John would care. What did Kendall think she would do about it anyway? Call up the news? Best headliner ever. Oh, yeah. I've decided that that monstrosity is my son after all. Because some homeless kid whose only friend is an empty imitation of the extinguished light of my life stalked me outside my gym and told me what a nice guy he was. By the way, you anti-playground people, you have it totally wrong. And then Ace is rebooted, and everybody thinks artificial personalities are fine, and everyone holds hands and sings songs about bluebirds and rainbows. Stupid. She sighed and leaned over to pick up her bag. Maybe she should get the last bit of her homework done. She hadn't had time last night because of her fool's errand up to Geist. A glimmer of movement in the otherwise empty hallways caught her eye. Weird. The announcement hollows shouldn't be up for at least another half hour. Kendall pressed up into the corner of the vestibule, trying to get a better look through the window. And then she realized that the hollow that was playing had nothing to do with school. Floating in the middle of the atrium was a holographic scene from a hospital, a scene that was instantly recognizable to anyone who paid even the vaguest attention to echoes in the last few decades. The wall screens and beeping monitors, the tubes and wires snaking around a tiny hospital bed, the central image from the Baby Esty campaign. But in the middle of the projection, the dark-haired baby wasn't gasping for air. Instead, she was staring lifelessly into nothing, lying deadly still. The wires and tubes were tangled tight around her body, choking her purple and blue. The usual message that orbited the image, "Help us save baby Esty," had been replaced with a nonsense phrase, "Tell me about Scheherazade." Well, that was the last straw. Wasn't it enough that they were going to shut Asa off forever just because of an accident that no flesh-and-blood person would even have been able to avoid? Wasn't it enough that echoes were considered subhuman, even as people used their minds to power the playground? Esty Bloom was a snotty engreída, but not even she deserved to come to school and see something like this. The inner door also had an analog lock, so Kendall made quick work of it. She didn't waste time trying to shut down the projection. It would be idiotic for a high school to leave any controls for the hollow announcements in a kid-accessible area. Instead, she made her way to the school library. The halls of the Park School felt especially unwelcoming this morning. She didn't need her classmates to make her feel like she didn't belong. The building itself glared internally at her imposition. She fixed her gaze on the floor tiles, hunching past the rows of towering maroon lockers that lined the hallway. In the library, Kendall hesitated behind the control desk. She had watched people sign her into the rig enough times that she could do it herself, but this felt like far more of a trespass than picking a door lock, and far more dangerous. But what was the other option? Leave that message floating in the middle of the entryway for anyone to see? For Esty to see? Alejigada con esto. Kendall used the IG chip in her playground license to boot up the full rig and open the mudroom interface. Then she kicked off her shoes at the door of the cubicle, settled among the halo globes, melted through the calibration sequence, and pushed her way onto the playground as fast as she could. She pawed through storefronts and data blocks and eventually found the administrative entrance to the Park School. There was a soft barrier around it, presumably to keep students from messing with vital systems. It would be enough to block out someone with a simple interface, but Kendall could do much more with a full rig. She used a wedge program that she had lifted from Ace's rainstorm break-in and squeezed through as if she were toothpaste coming out of a tube. She started casting around for the announcement projector, flipping through code and locked files. But before she found the projector, she found the footprints of another break-in. That had to be whoever had posted that disgusting hollow. Sure enough, the intruder's tracks led her straight to the projector. She spread the programming out in front of her, looking for bits that didn't seem to belong. And there it was, glowing yellow and slimy-looking. The hijacked projection taunted her as if daring her to remove it. Kendall glared back. She was no turn generation librarian. Whoever had set this in here hadn't anticipated a programmer of Kendall's caliber finding it. She reached out with a few of her programming tools, ready to scoop the intrusive bits out of the projector code. But then the mudroom came up from behind and swallowed her. "No, don't," she gasped through the fade of the mudroom. Had she booted up the rig wrong? Why had it kicked her out of the playground? "Kendall Owens," the voice boomed through the mudroom. Kendall could almost feel it vibrating the interface program. Her stomach sank. Caught in the act, there was nothing to do but let the rig finish its calibration cycle and watch the mudroom fade into the library cubicle. Mr. Espadas, the school librarian, was staring down at her when the halo globes released her mind completely into the real world. His face, once it had let go of its expression of abject terror, contorted with fury. Kendall hadn't even known Mr. Espadas was capable of getting angry. She lay petrified in the rig, unable to move. "You had better have a really good explanation for yourself," he said. "I'm really sorry, but did you see? Put your shoes on and come with me." Kendall rolled out of the rig on shaky legs. She fumbled with her shoelaces, finally knotting them when Mr. Espadas cleared his throat impatiently. She almost retreated back into the cubicle when she saw who was at the control desk. Mr. Mason, the principal of the Park School. She felt like a prisoner as the two of them escorted her to the main office. Students were starting to trickle in, and she felt everyone's eyes on her. She caught a glimpse of Haley leaning over to whisper something to one of her cronies, and they dissolved into giggles. Kendall wished she could sink into the floor. At least the hollow had been taken down. Kendall wondered fleetingly if they had gotten rid of it before Estee got to school. The office door closed behind them with the finality of a jail cell clanging shut. Kendall clutched her backpack to her chest. "I'm trying to understand," said Mr. Mason. Kendall couldn't meet his eyes. She stared at the gray pattern of the carpet, trying not to feel sick. "Let's leave aside for now breaking into school before it officially opens. Let's leave aside how unbelievably dangerous it is to use an extension rig without a monitor. You have a license. You know that. It won't do either of us any good to lecture you about it." Kendall blinked. If they left both of those offenses aside, what was left? Why was she here? "You know that bullying is not tolerated at this school. You of all people should know how much harm it can do to a learning environment. What came over you?" "Bullying? Have you been fighting with Esther Bloom?" "No, you don't understand. Kendall, whatever is going on between the two of you, this kind of behavior is completely unacceptable. I gave you your scholarship because I thought you had an incredible amount of potential. We made a lot of special exceptions for you, including sponsoring that full rig license. And now this comes up, and I have to ask myself if it was the right thing to do after all." Excuse me. Kendall's brain finally caught up with what Mr. Mason was saying to her. They thought she had put up the hollow. They were talking about expelling her from the Park School. A spike of panic shot through her. They were going to send her back to IPS just because she was trying to protect stupid Estee Bloom from some idiota's tasteless political statement. Everything she had worked for, a chance at a good life, a rest for her dad so he didn't work himself to death, everything gone. If Mr. Espadas hadn't been standing behind her, she would have run out of the office. And as it was, she had to push down a bubble of sobs that seemed determined to choke its way out of her mouth. But then she realized the bubble wasn't sadness or fear, it was frustration. Anger. I'm sure this looked bad, but listen to them judging her without even hearing her side of the story. Who did they think they were? She looked up from the floor and skewered Mr. Mason with her glare. "You're not even going to ask me what happened, are you?" "Excuse me?" It was Mr. Mason's turn to blink in surprise. Kendall knew she should shut up, but she couldn't stop herself. She never talked back to her classmates when they tore her down. She never talked back to Ms. Rita when she went off on Kendall or her father. She never stood up to anyone, no matter how badly they were treating her. Why was she the only one who had to take it as everyone else in the world dished it out? "Ain't no way there's another explanation, is there? You dirty your school up with some basura you lifted from IPS, and it's only a matter of time before she starts stinking up the place, right?" Mr. Mason's face flushed bright red, and Kendall bit down on her tongue. She felt her own cheeks redden as she dropped her eyes back to the carpet. She had definitely gone too far. The tears were back, and her vision blurred with them. This had been her best chance. She could just imagine Ms. Rita's "I told you so" smirk. She wondered if she could die right on the spot without just by wishing it. "Okay, look, I have to talk to you," said a new voice through the door of Mr. Mason's office. Kendall looked up just as Mr. Espadas gasped and jumped aside. Esty Bloom's holographic avatar had popped up right where Mr. Espadas had been standing. The projection was distorted and run through with spherical bubbles of static. Kendall could see the wheels of Esty's projector under the crack of the door. Great, just what she needed. The coup de grace. Mr. Mason and Mr. Espadas exchanged a glance. "Esther, we're aware of the situation and we're handling it. You've never disrespected a closed door in my school before." "A lot of that going around today," grumbled Mr. Espadas. "Kendall's in there, isn't she? Kendall Owens." Kendall risked a glance to the door. Esty's avatar was staring a foot to the left of Mr. Mason's shoulder. She realized that Esty couldn't see through the door, and somehow that made her feel a little better. "Like I said, we're handling the situation. Please don't make things more complicated than they already are." "It's already more complicated, Mr. Mason. You think Kendall put up the hollow, don't you? But she didn't. She was trying to take it down." Kendall stared openly as Mr. Mason opened the door without a word. The static cleared when the projector gained back line of sight. Esty rolled into the office and didn't even wait until Mr. Mason closed the door before she started talking. "I saw that thing on the hollow when I troubleshot my playground connection to the school this morning. It refers to someone..." A short murmur of overlapping words interrupted Esty's speech in an uneasy tone. Kendall narrowed her eyes. She had never heard an experienced echo concept belch before. Then Esty interrupted it with a throat-clearing sound clip, which struck Kendall as absurd. Esty didn't have a throat to clear. Then she continued. "There were two sets of footprints leading up to the hollow program. The thing was inserted at 4 a.m. Kendall didn't find it until just now." "How did you know about it, Kendall?" "I saw it through the door." Her anger flared up again, but she pushed it back. "Almost had it, too. Might have gotten it so she never even knew about it." Mr. Mason looked from Kendall to Esty and back again. "We're going to have to discuss this. It goes without saying that we're invalidating your license." "But, Kendall, you broke into my school this morning to use a restricted machine that could have killed you. You may have had the best motives in the world, but the best motives in the world don't excuse poor judgment." The hollow bubble reformed in Kendall's chest. Without a license, how would she access the playground? All public rigs required one. Maybe she could manage her storefront through a basic interface, but how would she program new designs? The one she had barely made her enough to cover lunch. How would she make enough to rent an apartment without a new breakout? She and her dad would have to stay with Miss Rita forever. The bell rang just then, a clear mechanical tone that warned students that they had 10 minutes to get to class. "You girls had better get going," said Mr. Mason. Mr. Espadas opened the door for them, trying to catch Kendall's eye, but Kendall wasn't ready to let him apologize, not even with a sheepish glance. She let Esty roll her projector out first, then began to leave herself when Mr. Mason cleared his throat. "I'm sorry we jumped to conclusions," he said. "I'm glad it didn't happen like we assumed." Kendall considered saying something back, but didn't trust herself to open her mouth. She followed Esty out without a word. The halls were streaming with students heading in the general direction of their first period class. They had to wait for a break in the stream before they could join the flow. "I thought they were going to kick me out," Kendall said, before she even realized she was going to speak. Esty's avatar smiled, but Kendall looked instead at the cameras on her projector. The echoes on the playground were always talking about how no one ever looked into their eyes. Esty's cameras were flicking back and forth over the students, but then they stopped and focused up on Kendall when she noticed that Kendall wasn't looking at the avatar. "It's okay," said Kendall. "I don't want anyone to see you talking to me either." She nearly stepped into the stream of students, but Esty's voice stopped her. "Why did you do it?" she asked. "You got yourself in mierda hasta el cuello. You don't even like me." "Whoever put that thing up, they're getting to you." She's not." "Claro que sí, she is. No echo past her first year loses control of her language interface like you did a few minutes ago." Esty paused. "I'm really sorry they pulled your license. I have one of your designs in my squirt library. The chocolate chip cookie? It's really good." Kendall fought down pride and loss and managed to say nothing. You know, we have a rig at our house for my family. You know, perks of being a big corporation spokesmonkey. You can use it if you want, and I'll get my big brother to monitor. Meet me after school, same spot as last time. The bright possibility flashed briefly in the gloom of the rest of Kendall's day, but she pulled back from it quickly. She knew from long experience to distrust friendly gestures. Girls like Esty smile at you, get you to trust them, get you to open up to the possibility of having someone you could talk to. And then they take whatever you give them in your naive hope and use it to gut you in public, in front of as many people as possible. And if you're desperate enough, they do it again and again. These days, Kendall knew better than to trust anyone other than her dad, who would continue killing himself with work, trying to get ahead in a career that had moved on without him while he cared for Kendall's mother. And maybe Asa, who was languishing on a server behind EchoCorp's firewalls on the playground that she no longer had access to. He was farther away than ever. It was an easy enough decision now that she was thinking clearly. She didn't have to trust Esty at all. All she had to do was keep her mouth shut and her thoughts to herself, and she'd have access to the playground again. Vale, she said. Same spot as last time.
And hello, we are back. This is Jim Freund over WBAI in New York City. The program is Hour of the Wolf. You just heard Danielle T. Friedman. D.T. Friedman is the byline. Reading on Tuesday, February 4th, 2014, at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And again, what can I say other than this is listener-sponsored radio? We do programming like nobody else, not even the other Pacifica programs. Excuse me, not even the other Pacifica radio stations have quite the same program. This is because we are community in nature, local in nature. There is a lot to be said even as we move to either a more national model or a leased management model or whatever it is, that community programming that sounds different at each station and reflects who the people are at each station and who the listeners are at each station are very important. And that is why the survival of WBAI is so important. And our theme this fundraising drive has been, and will continue to be, the program is the premium. Well, I hope you enjoyed the premium. I thought it was a darned good one. The audience of plus 60 people thought so as well. And it's now time for you to donate, if you have not already done so, to WBAI, to become a subscriber and say, yes, that is programming that I like. You need to continue doing literary programming. In fact, I think you need to do more literary programming and radio dramas and arts programming in general. And, of course, utmost in your mind is I Heart Hour of the Wolf. And you do that by making a phone call. 212-209-2950 is the phone number to call. 212-209-2950. And pledge that $50 or $25 or $100, what have you, during this program so that this program gets credited. Or you can also go to WBAI.org and follow the various links there to donate money. And then there'll be a drop-down box that says, what is your favorite program? And, well, duh, Hour of the Wolf. But the most important thing is to send us money to show Pacifica Radio, to show our program director, to show your neighbors that WBAI is not gone, that with your support it will not be gone, and that this kind of programming is programming that you admire and support. 212-209-2950. Again, 212-209-2950. Please make that call right now. Right now. 212-209-2950. I'm going to sit here and wait until I see phone calls coming. Oh, it's a recording. I can't do that. I mean, I could, but it'd be really, really stupid. Which wouldn't be a first for me, but hey. 212-209-2950. I trust you are calling. I hope you are calling. I pray you are calling. My God, I watched again My Fair Lady, and, you know, Higgins goes, listen to the rhetoric of this man. Never mind. A couple of you know what I was talking about. At any rate, if things work out properly, as hoped, next week on this program, we are going to do not just a Pete Seeger special, but a folky special, folk music / singer-songwriter special, personal remembrances of happy days in Greenwich Village, some of which were produced by WBAI, and some of which are simply times that we are a part of, were a part of, and continue to celebrate here. And I intend to be here live playing music for you and talking about some of those times. So please tune in again next week at 1:30 in the morning. That should be February 12th. It's not February 11th. A few of you probably know what I'm referring to there. But an interesting day for WBAI in the vast long history that I have enjoyed and celebrated here. So, again, thank you for listening, and talk to you next week. Good morning.
There are many causes of climate chaos, such as the way we use and get energy, and many solutions, such as renewable energy. This Saturday, February 8th, from 1 to 4 p.m. at the Long Beach Public Library, will be a town meeting with experts and music. Join us Saturday, February 8th, 1 to 4 p.m. at the Long Beach Public Library, right near the Long Beach train station on Long Island.
There once was a union made.
Monday, WBAI starts our critical February pledge drive. There will also be a relaunch of much of the station's format. This upcoming Black History Month, you'll hear the voices you enjoy hearing, but you'll also hear your voice should you choose to call in. Morning drive and afternoon drive, you'll get local voices, non-corporate news, and a pro-union view you just won't hear anywhere else. WBAI, Arts and Labor Radio for the Tri-State, to the right of NPR on the dial, and to the left on everything else that matters.
Oh, you pass there. Me, I'm sticking to the union. I'm sticking to the union.
The New York African Chorus Ensemble's Celebrate Diversity, Celebrate You Festival will preview on Saturday, February 15th at 7 p.m. to benefit WBAI, featuring legacy women and all-women group of singers, dancers, and drummers rooted in Afro-Dominican and Afro-Puerto Rican traditions, and Neil O'Leary's percussive Irish music and dance ensemble, and the New York African Chorus Ensemble, directed by Joyce Adewumi. That's Saturday, February 15th, 7 to 10 p.m. at Big Road in Chelsea, 235 West 23rd Street, between 7th and 8th Avenues in Manhattan. Suggested admission just $15 to benefit WBAI. No one will be turned away for lack of funds. There'll also be food and lots of space for dancing. For more information, go to bigroadinchelsea.org.
Hi, this is Tony Roberts. And you're listening to WBAI in New York, the voice of truth since 1960.
Like the grateful dead.
Interrupting all programs.
We are controlling transmission.
Your mind is totally controlled.
Now, I am talking about your 50,000-watt intensive care unit, babies!
New York, just like I pictured it.
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
Pacifica Radio in New York City presents The Morning Dew Show. Concerts, rarities, and tasty tidbits from the greatest era of music ever. Every Sunday morning from 1 to 3 a.m. And only here at 99.5 FM, WBAI, New York.
Welcome to this edition of Morning Dew. I'm Stu Robbins, and if it seems like 2014 just began, it has. I have news for you. We're about a month into it, which brings us to an event that happens this time every year. It's almost Super Bowl Sunday. So in honor of that, I thought we'd play some of the super groups of rock this morning. We'll take a look at a few of these bands, see where they started, and go a few degrees of separation between them. So let's kick it into gear with this one. Leslie West, Corky Lang, and Felix Pappalardi, collectively known as Mountain, and take this Nantucket sleigh ride together on Morning Dew, WBAI, New York City.
A year ago, we had an album out called Nantucket Sleigh Ride. Yeah. We'd like very much now to do the title tune from that album.
Sleeping in watch way, the bedroom.